The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, Director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. We're recording this on Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. If you like this podcast, please check out our free weekly newsletter, An Irreverent Take on Recent Court of Appeals Opinions, and our sister podcast, the documentary series, Bound by Oath. We are especially pleased to bring you today's show because we have a special guest. Over the last few years, you may have heard of federal crimes that you didn't know existed, or more likely, didn't ever imagine might exist, such as selling Limburger cheese unless it's more than 2 months old, or selling sparklers without warning people not to touch the glowing wire. The man behind this renaissance in criminal awareness is Mike Chase. He's the author of How to Become a Federal Criminal. He runs the Twitter account A Crime a Day. He's a graduate of the University of Connecticut Law School, and he's also a lawyer. He's here today, appropriately enough, to talk about a case involving Twitter. Mike, welcome to Short Circuit.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And how many crimes are you up to now on the Twitter account?
Whatever 7 and years and some change times 365 is. So I think at last count it was well over 2,000 crimes. And by last count, I have about 830 years left to go to count them all. So I'm getting pretty close.
Oh, wow. So do you have a plan of like either cryogenic storage or passing the account off to your descendants? You know, some kind of detail perhaps?
On cryogenic freezing, the full body is like $250,000, but you can do a head-only cryogenic for like $40,000.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm saving up for that. I've got about $550 saved up for head-only cryogenic freezing. That's the current plan. My son has shown no interest in tweeting crimes. Committing them is a different story.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe that'll all change and you've got time to shake it out. Well, we'll be hearing from Mike very shortly. Also joining us is Diana Simpson, an IJ attorney. She doesn't tweet about federal crimes, well, not very much, but she does enjoy a good Eighth Amendment violation, or at least cases about them. She'll be sharing one of those in a little bit. Welcome back, Diana.
Thank you, Anthony.
Well, my Congressman Devin Nunes isn't a big fan of criticism, and he sued a lot of people for picking on him, including someone who contends to be his cow. Most of these lawsuits have gone nowhere, but it seems like the Eighth Circuit has given him a bit of a lifeline. What's going on?
So this recent decision in Nunes versus Lizza and Hearst is sort of an interesting Court of Appeals decision, mostly because it comes years into the many years long saga of Devin Nunes suing people who've criticized him in various fora, so Twitter or in the press or on television. And this is a particularly interesting one because one, the decision is so fresh, but two, it comes, you know, a little while after Devin Nunes's cow Twitter account has crossed, half a million or more followers on Twitter and become some people's favorite person on Twitter. But, you know, this, or I guess our favorite bovine on Twitter, I should say.
Right.
But this decision comes procedurally on a motion to dismiss, a successful motion to dismiss in the Northern District of Iowa. And this is a case that is just sort of a core defamation case, and it proceeded on two different theories. The essence of it is it stems from an article that Lizza wrote and that Hearst published in which it was suggested, or you know, some could argue stated explicitly, that Nunes had a deep, dark political secret. And the idea was that Nunes, who comes from these agrarian roots, and that part of his folkish appeal as a congressman is that, you know, his life and his upbringing was this, you know, farm-based upbringing. He's a man of the people. And that this California dairy farm really was baked into his identity. But the suggestion by this article was that his secret was that the farm had secretly been moved to Iowa, and that the farm had secretly been employing undocumented labor. And Nunez took issue with this. And unlike most folks who have had, you know, that have been in political life, congressmen who have had countless articles, true or debunked, published about them, Nunez continued on his campaign to litigate the truth of these articles in court and sued on two theories of defamation. The first one was sort of an express defamation theory, basically saying you published purported facts about me that are factually false. And then alternatively, under this implication defamation theory, you know, the whole overall structure of your article ends up casting me in a light and ends up suggesting things that are not true, even if they aren't said explicitly. And ultimately, the district court granted the motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss proceeded on these theories that neither count of this complaint stated a claim for defamation, that it was either justifiable opinion that was stated in this article, that all these suggestions about political motivations to spike the Russia investigation or to advance certain immigration policies were all part and parcel of this deep political secret to hide undocumented labor on the Nunez farm. You know, the motion to dismiss said this is either opinion or it is of this literary nature that it can't really be taken as fact. And the district court agreed. The district court said this complaint does not state a claim for defamation under either theory. There are not express statements that are false. And under the by implication theory, the overall structure of the article, the district court said, is disjointed enough that the suggestions about Nunez himself are sufficiently separate from the allegations about the Nunez family and the Nunez farm. And so the motion to dismiss was successful. Well, on appeal, the Eighth Circuit disagreed and essentially salvaged parts of the Nunez complaint. And the Eighth Circuit said a colorable claim for defamation has been stated in this complaint. And it's a little bit tricky, right? I mean, most of the people that are going to be listening are lawyers. Most of the people that are going to be closely following this are lawyers and know all too well what the standard is on a motion to dismiss. To the average person, this Court of Appeals opinion looks in many ways like the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals is saying that defamation did in fact occur, that this article was in fact defamatory. But as we all know, the standard on a motion to dismiss is, assuming all of the allegations in the complaint are true, is a claim stated. And so the Eighth Circuit basically just said on its face, if we take Nunez at his word, and at his word meaning when Nunez says in his complaint that none of this stuff about him is true, then this complaint can't survive. And it's actually a fairly straightforward Court of Appeals opinion, except it's got this truth upon lie upon truth aspect to it, which makes it somewhat fascinating, because we all know that Nunez, as a public figure, an elected public figure, sort of the most public criticizable type of figure that there is out there, has a higher burden of pleading when it comes to a defamation claim. In this case, he would have to prove actual malice, and the Eighth Circuit said, look, it may very well be the case that the article, when it was first published, did not demonstrate malice, okay? We'll give him that sort of like, in the dog bite case, we give him one bite, right? They published this thing, Nunez says it's not true, let's let it slide. But Lizza then publishes on Twitter, they call it a republication. Lizza takes issue with that and says it is not a republication. But the Eighth Circuit said when he tweeted this article after Nunez took issue with the article in the first place, that alone was enough to plead actual malice. And if credited as true, if found to be true by the fact finder, then that could satisfy the element of actual malice here. The fact that Lizza tweeted it and reached a new audience after Nunez had been concerned about
it. When he did that, right, he wasn't merely a retweet, but it was a retweet with like a sentence explainer, yes. Right? Something right. like that. Okay.
Right. The question, query whether a retweet would have been a republication. What he did was effectively a quote tweet, or he tweeted out the article again, and he said, "Hey, Nunez is in the news. Boy, have I got a story for you." And so the Eighth Circuit found it significant that he was potentially reaching and actually did reach a new audience by republishing it. So the upshot of the case is that the motion to dismiss should not have been successful, according to the Eighth Circuit, and that Nunez stays alive once again in one of his many defamation cases for unfavorable articles.
It also provides another example of the perils of Twitter. And so some folks are very good at running their Twitter account without getting into trouble. But I think many people are not. And so this provides an example of a place to be cautious once again on Twitter.
There are no perils on Twitter. What are you talking about? Perils of Twitter.
There's always one person who it's their story of the day on Twitter, and your goal is to not be that person. Right?
That's right. That's right.
Some
never
people
be the main
turn
character.
That into a book, though.
That's true.
So
I mean, look,
opportunity.
You're exactly right. I mean, one of the big things when I was publishing How to Become a Federal Criminal, like, the publisher reached out and they said, "Can we, like, even publish this book? Are we allowed to publish a book that sort of describes all the federal crimes on the books? Like, can we even do that?" And I said, "I don't know, probably." I had to, like, sign a contract that said that nothing in the book violated federal law, which, like, how can you, like, say that? But anyway, the whole thing about Twitter is that it is this, like, overly candid, oversharing place. And here, Twitter, you're right, Twitter ended up being a main character in this Eighth Circuit opinion because malice was established by tweeting. Right. You know, you could publish something in Hearst Media. I mean, that's a behemoth of media. You publish it there, you get a free pass, but you tweet it out later after Devin Nunez gets upset about it. And all of a sudden you found yourself in a viable defamation case. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. So I guess retweet with caution is the lesson here. We'll see where this goes. I mean, I think a lot of people are fairly upset with this decision. But I do think, look, I mean, you know, motions to dismiss, assume all the facts are true. If Nunez says in his complaint that he has no secret, he has no political secret, the court is supposed to credit that. So
what was interesting to me was that they had this kind of discussion about how the defamation by implication, it wasn't protected opinion under the First Amendment because it's not rhetorical hyperbole in a work of literary journalism, they say, because this is a piece of investigative journalism and the audience is likely to interpret it as conveying facts, like assertion of objective facts. And so that's an interesting kind of discussion, particularly in this hyper-partisan environment in which the lines between fact and opinion are often very muddled. And it really brings to mind to me these recent news anchor cases, or not news anchor cases, with Rachel Maddow and Tucker Carlson. Both of whom have won basically a dismissal of a defamation case brought by people saying, "Hey, these people defamed me on their show." And the court saying, "Nobody's going to interpret this as fact. This is just opinion on, by a person on the news who's not actually a news anchor, but just giving their opinion." And it's interesting to kind of see the dynamic between these kinds of cases and, you know, defamation may be an old type of tort, but it's certainly not unchanged by modern times.
That's a great point because that is a huge new dynamic where each person, you know, the sides of the political spectrum keep latching onto these decisions, which are largely procedural decisions, right? The kind of arguments that lawyers would of course make, which is to say, you can't actually interpret this as objective fact. This is not just, you know, hard fact reporting, because of course it's an obvious defense to any defamation case is to say, you know, no reasonable listener or no reasonable viewer or reader is going to interpret this as hard facts. This is commentary. You know, there's a lot of color in this, you know. It is happening on both sides of the political spectrum, right? MSNBC, Fox News, nobody is immune to this. Obviously, Hearst Media is not immune to this, and Ryan Lizza is not immune to this, is that whenever it suits them, they're going to argue in these defamation cases that no person would assume that this or take this as objective fact. And I think it's, in addition to being an interesting procedural commentary on the law of defamation, it is interesting commentary on the state of journalism, right? In that it is what is the reasonable viewer supposed to take as true and to take as fact? And at what point, you know, I mean, for all of the warts on this case and all of the odiousness on this case, does Nunez, is he end up being the messenger of a deeper point, which is that maybe we should have higher expectations of our media to stand by their reporting and say every person should take this as fact because it is fact, because it's well-sourced and it is true. Again, you know, the lawyer in me knows that is not actually what's being said here. But I think for a bystander, somebody watching the courts from the cheap seats, might have a little bit of concern that every time a journalist finds himself in court, they're saying, you can't trust anything that I say.
Well, I'm no expert on defamation laws, especially Iowa's defamation law, although I do live next door in Minnesota. But I thought that, you know, maybe the ins and outs of whether you can have defamation by implication with this set of facts is true or not, not something I could opine on. But the malice standard, that where the rubber hit the road at the end of the opinion, where there actually is a cause of action, and how the malice standard applies to that did seem to me a bit of a stretch and a worrying stretch, which was right after the Nunez asks for New York Times versus Sullivan to be overturned because that's the one, of course, that gave us the malice standard in the first place. And the court is like, well, we can't do that. Of course, they're preserving it for the Supreme Court, but it didn't even sound like they presented it as preserving it. They just asked for the Eighth Circuit to overturn New York Times versus Sullivan. But after that, this retweet where Lizza just says a couple of things. I mean, it seems like the reason why that, you know, doesn't get – that could be actual malice and then the earlier publication isn't, is the fact that Nunez in his complaint says, well, this isn't true. And so then he's on notice that it isn't true. Yeah. But the standard has to be much beefier. That my understanding is much beefier than that. Then it's not just the person you're accusing of doing whatever says, oh, that's not true. It's the person you're accusing of whatever, you know, presents evidence beyond just he said, she said, or there's some other evidence that comes to light that shows, look, you really were wrong when you were saying that. It's not like they just made this up. The article quoted people who were other farmers in the area. I'm not sure if they were anonymous or not. I assume they were anonymous in the article saying, yeah, they're hiring undocumented laborers or what have you. That's pretty worrying for the actual malice standard. And so, that, you know, I hope that this becomes just an asterisk in defamation law, or that something else. I know, I think it's unlikely it would go en banc, but we'll see. There's an interesting write up by our friends at TechDirt that came out right after the decision came out for those interested in the ins and outs of defamation. But that was my main takeaway, knowing a little bit about actual malice, is that, you know, actual malice means actual malice.
Right. Do you want Devin Nunez or any newsworthy person who feels slighted by reporting on them, do you want them to be able to create their own de facto gag order by being able to just send you notice that they disagree with what your reporting is? And then if you continue to speak beyond me telling you I disagree with the facts, purported facts reported, you will now have demonstrated actual malice, right? Oh, I will survive a motion to dismiss, and I will put you past the pleading stage in litigation and incur all the costs associated with it. I mean, that's right. That is a little bit worrying.
And could that defeat a slap motion if we're in a state with a slap suit, which is a statute, which is a defense that you can have in defamation cases? So anyways, there's some worrying elements here, but also some thought-provoking questions that Mike and Diana have given us. So thanks very much to Mike Chase for relating us to Devin Nunes, who I don't think has been mentioned on Short Circuit before and hopefully won't very much in the future.
Hopefully we won't get sued for defamation.
Now. And that too. Thank you. Thank you, Diana, for addressing the elephant in the room. Are you now going to tell us about an Eighth Amendment violation involving Twitter?
Not involving Twitter, but it does involve the Eighth Amendment. And some people may suggest that Twitter does also involve cruel and unusual punishment.
True.
But this one is thankfully perhaps a little bit taken away from Twitter. So this case, it comes to us out of the Ninth Circuit. And so Daniel Costin is an inmate at California State Prison Sacramento. And he's in his late 50s and suffers from a degenerative joint disease that causes chronic pain all over his body. And so because of this disease, the prison physician has prescribed morphine to treat his pain. And so the prison policy has a specific policy for morphine because it's a narcotic. And it requires that the nurse delivering the medication and the guard escorting the nurse have to watch the inmate ingest the medicine. And so that way they can't stock up a stockpile somewhere or distribute to other inmates, but they have to actually take the medicine in front of both the nurse and the guard. But as with many policies, the California State Prison Sacramento nurse and guard delivering this medicine cut corners a little bit. And so sometimes they would leave meds in empty cells while inmates were in the yard. And that is indeed what happened with Costin, it would appear. And so he had given a guard a magazine to deliver to another inmate, and the guard found two of these morphine pills taped inside. So the guard searched his cell and found a stash of 50 morphine pills that Costin had hoarded in violation of the policy. So the guard confiscated the pills and disciplined Costin. In response, the doctor cut off his prescription completely. And so he didn't evaluate Costin before. He didn't taper him off of morphine. In fact, he didn't even see him for nearly 4 months after cutting off the prescription. And this is despite the fact that morphine has people who are cut off just cold turkey from morphine often experience withdrawal that is very uncomfortable. Indeed, 11 days after his medicine was cut off, a nurse found Costin on the floor in his cell, surrounded by his own vomit and heavily sweating, both of which are symptoms of morphine withdrawal. He ultimately recovered, but he continued to report severe and debilitating pain, and he asked for morphine again, and they said, no, we're not going to give it back to you because of this hoarding situation. So he sued, alleging deliberate indifference, and he represented himself at trial, and the court granted judgment against him. So this was back in 2015. The Ninth Circuit ended up reversing that in 2016 and remanded for a second trial, where Costin once again represented himself. And so he presented evidence of this medication management policy, but the district court excluded it as irrelevant and then gave the jury an instruction that you should give deference to prison officials in the adoption and execution of policies and practices that, in their judgment, are needed to preserve discipline and to maintain internal security. Costin objected to this and cited a case that a close facsimile of a Ninth Circuit case saying that this was an inappropriate jury instruction, but the district court disregarded that. And the jury returned a verdict for the medical staff and said that this was not deliberate indifference in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And so it's now up at the Ninth Circuit once again, although this time Costin is represented by counsel who is at least briefing the case. And so it talks about this Ninth Circuit case back from 2015 that says that trial courts in these prison medical care cases can't instruct jurors to defer to prison policies unless there's some plausible connection between the policy and the challenged medical care decision. You can't just always instruct the jury to defer in these medical care cases because no other circuit does that. And that's nuts. That's just way too much deference in these kinds of cases. And so they go through the facts here and they say, you know, of course it's reasonable for a prison to want to prevent pill hoarding. But the policy already protects against that. The guard and the nurse were supposed to watch him ingest the pills, not leave them in the empty cell. And he's not challenging that policy. He's challenging their decision to cut him off of the morphine without tapering. And cutting him off the morphine without tapering sure seems to be unnecessary, unjustified, or exaggerated, according to the Ninth Circuit. That just, you know, that's really a step too far for the prison to have taken. And so the court holds that the jury instruction was wrong and remands for a third trial, which is kind of bananas to think about, that this inmate is now on his second appeal and has gotten a new trial once again. And so, you know, are the defendants at this point going to settle to avoid a third trial? If they go to trial, is he going to represent himself again, or is he at this point going to have an attorney? I mean, he seems to be a pretty capable defendant representing his own interests. I mean, he's citing a case close enough that the court understood what he was talking about. He's now won two cases at the Ninth Circuit on this issue, which, I mean, a lot of people with very good representation lose at the Ninth Circuit on one issue once, let alone going up twice.
It looked like this time he had a clinic that helped him out.
Well, at the Ninth Circuit. At the Ninth Circuit, right. So who knows what will happen at if there's a third trial. Will he be represented, or is he going to go it alone once again?
He's pretty good, so.
Yeah?
That's remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable to have that much success and to be able to preserve issues. I mean, granted, he may be getting a little bit of deference from the courts who recognize that he's pro se. And, you know, but that only goes so far. I mean, people get slapped out of court on representing themselves pro se all the time. So for him to be able to survive this much, have issues adequately preserved, the Ninth Circuit's not going to just look over that. I mean, that's remarkable. But the deeper issue here, the sort of merits issue about deference to medical policies that the Department of Corrections is promulgating is obviously worrisome, because I don't like deference to any government entity as it is, and particularly where, I mean, we have a cause of action, you know, a claim under 1983 for deliberate indifference. The reason that deliberate indifference exists is because there's a heck of a lot of deliberate indifference that happens inside of prisons. And so you have an organization that has to have a whole cause of action for deliberate indifference, violation of constitutional rights. I'm not sure that that's the entity that I want to defer to, you know, on setting what's necessary from a medical policy perspective. I mean, even just from a federal criminal perspective, you know, I can remember back a bunch of months ago, maybe years ago, I did, you know, 18 U.S.C. 1791, which is a federal criminal statute, which has all kinds of regulations promulgated under it, where it's about providing prison contraband. But they, again, the legislature has essentially ceded entirely defining what prison contraband is to the prison guards and the wardens and et cetera. The problem with that is, it's like, you can't even you can't mail a toupee to a prisoner. You can't send a wig. If you send a medically unnecessary wig to a federal prisoner, you have committed a federal crime under 18 U.S.C. 1791. And that's because, like, they just locked down, you know, what is deemed medically necessary for folks. So I don't know. When you're talking about somebody who's going to go through the unenviable throes of morphine withdrawal, I'm just glad that this guy's had his days in court, because I think that this is an issue worth, you know, plowing the depths of.
Yeah, and it certainly brings to mind, you know, this whole issue of deference. I mean, this is something that at IJ we certainly have to deal with quite a bit, because the courts yeah. are always very hands off, and the legislatures, you know, they deserve all the deference in the world. Why? That's literally never been explained in a way that makes sense to me. But particularly here, right? I mean, you know, I think what a lot of it comes down to is judges just saying, you know, inmates. I don't want to deal with that. But yeah. that's not how it's supposed to work. You know, you can't constantly defer to other people. I mean, this is a guy who was going through very uncomfortable symptoms, and, you know, whether it's morphine withdrawal or whether it's his underlying pain, I mean, you shouldn't have to go through pain just because of this other thing that you did. And so he should be able to treat his pain in prison. And, you know, if they have to watch him ingest the pills, so be it. That seems like a reasonable policy to avoid this exact problem. But, you know.
And the craziest part about it all, it seems like the court didn't even emphasize this as much as it could have, is that their policy was to do that in the first place. And they were, because they weren't doing that, he was able to get away with, it seems like maybe he was taking some of the pills and then keeping some of them, it's splitting the difference. And so that's why he got this stash of morphine. So if they'd just gone back to the actual policy that they were supposed to be enforcing, he would have been able to come down off the meds. So how is that not just embarrassing, or, you know, an estoppel of some kind against the deference? So, you know, the court ended up as it ended up, but it's, you almost wonder how could it be anything else, given that they don't even follow their own damn policy?
Well, and yeah. What was, I think, somewhat troubling to me anyway, is that the Ninth Circuit said, look, it's still possible for the government to win here. They just have to demonstrate that there is a plausible connection between this policy of removing him from morphine cold turkey and, you know, whatever their policy is designed to protect against. And so here's how you would do it, government. And do they really need your help? I mean, they've got actual attorneys who've been litigating this the whole time against a pro se inmate litigant who keeps beating them. Maybe just, you know, hold back for a second and just let the parties fight it out.
I will tell you, I mean, you know, some of my favorite cases I've ever litigated and had the honor to represent have been taking on these pro bono prisoner cases, right? Ever since the Prisoners Litigation Reform Act has brought a whole bunch of talented litigators, I think, into the fold that would have otherwise not practiced in that area, and have gotten trained, you know, and you know, the training is not in depth, but it is a bunch of folks who have a critical eye and are good litigators. Now, in many districts, the District of Connecticut being one, you are on the wheel and you are required to take a case unless you have extreme cause why you wouldn't take one of these cases. And to represent folks that need your representation. I will tell you that when you step into one of these cases, particularly if you're somebody who is known in the jurisdiction and somebody who is known to be a talented litigator, once the other side starts seeing cogent arguments, oftentimes it's like you flipped the lights on and the bugs are scattering. It's like, oh my God, we're so used to just steamrolling these arguments, these complaints, these pro se complaints that come in, that sometimes if you get a litigant that is represented and you finesse the complaint a little bit, and all of a sudden you start realizing that there's really merit to what they've been arguing, all of a sudden, you know, real issues start getting shaken loose. And I can just tell you from litigating those cases, I am just shocked at the number of times that a complaint that came in written on college ruled paper in oftentimes really beautiful handwriting, by the way, you read through it and you go, this cannot possibly be true. There is no way that when I subpoena the records and that when I go through these records that they are going to support this claim, how indifferent and how craven some of these allegations are. The number of times that it is exactly true is just horrifying. It's just shocking. And so, yes, cold turkey non-taper from morphine, that's shocking. You know, some of the people that have had unbelievably horrific injuries or infections left to fester because of deliberate indifference is just remarkable. But again, my big takeaway from this case, in addition to how awful deference can be, is I'm just really impressed by this. By this plaintiff. I mean, this is just really remarkable, you know.
Maybe a career in law is in his future, indeed. I don't know what he's an inmate for, but who knows? Maybe he'll finish school and do this for real on the outside.
But look, we know incarcerated people oftentimes can be the best. They know the system better than anybody else, and they have the vigor. I mean, look, I always comes to mind is Sean Hopwood, who, you know, was incarcerated and was able to write, you know, one of the best cert petitions that, you know, folks had ever seen. And so this is not a voice to be dismissed. You know, these are people that often know the system extremely well, and they can establish some very good law. So I'm going to be watching this one too, because for that reason, exactly. Who knows how many appeals we're going to end up having in this one. So,
yeah, as we've learned more and gotten more into the criminal justice issues at IJ the last few years, the thing I've been most surprised of is just how bad prison is. I mean, you hear stories, you're always told, oh, you don't want to go to prison because it's really bad. They're like, well, obviously you can't leave. it's not just that you can't leave. There's a lot of incredibly bad things about American prisons. And this case is just one small example of that. Well, thank you for that elucidation on our prison systems and prisoner plaintiffs, who we should be proud of this guy and proud of the others that have somehow navigated the system. Thanks, Diana, for presenting that case and for joining us on Conversation today. So thank you again for joining us, Mike. You can get his book on all from all good booksellers, which I think are all online now. But it's How to Become a Federal Criminal. You'll learn a lot there. You'll learn how you can get into a federal prison in a number of different ways. And while you're not doing that, I will ask that all of you get engaged.